Okay, so we are recording on this machine. Okay. Well, good morning, everybody. It is September the 26th. The year is 2023, and you're listening to the Labor Beat Radio program, broadcasting on Enlightened Radio at enlightenedradio.org, and you can always find our player at player.enlightenedradio.org. And today, my good two good friends, Scott Marshall from Chicago and the Steelworker Retirees, and J.B. Christensen and myself from the West Virginia Retirees, but J.B. is, and I are also, J.B. is the president of our regional CLC here in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. Anyway, and so we've been doing this program off and on for a number, quite a few years, actually, in the local area. So today, there's two big items, you know, that are on the agenda in the labor movement. There's probably way more than that. Every district, I was told by the president of the state AFL-CIO last year, every state of the union, every CLC, the overwhelming number of them have either strike or potential strike activity going on. And so it's not just the headline events, but there's definitely something much broader and deeper than just the headline contract negotiations with UPS, which are concluded pretty much successfully, I think, by most observers. And now, of course, the United Auto Workers, whose strike has expanded to from the three or four core places to parts warehouses and distribution centers, including one right here in our local area here in Martinsburg, West Virginia, targeting GM and Stellantis more than Ford, because at the last report from President Sean Fain, there was movement at Ford on the key issues that are in dispute, which we get into again in the discussion there, but not so much or maybe not even at all at GM and Stellantis. So, you know, the rolling strike has developed into a tactic that can be targeted, and which is an interesting development. We can probably get into that a little bit as well. Anyway, and the other big issue, of course, is the settlement of the writers' part of the writers and actors walkout in Hollywood, that has a lot of implications for anybody involved in the creative arts, or anybody where you are wondering whether your creations that other people make millions out of, not to be some return for yourself, you know, having done that. So anyway, but having said that, why don't we open the discussion here? And I know Scott has a special note he wants to start with. And so why don't we start there? Scott Marshall, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, John. I just really want to raise a question that is quite painful for steelworkers and for myself, and that is that our international president, Tom Conway, passed away yesterday. And I have to say that not only is that a terrible loss for us steelworkers, but it's a terrible loss for the whole labor movement, because Conway has been such a fighter all across the board for the working class, for the whole working class, for the whole labor movement. And the things that he's done in our union, for our union, is just incredible. For example, on his initiative, our union forged a coalition with a co-op movement called Mondragon out of Spain, which basically takes when plants shut down, they turn them into co-ops and put the people back to work. And that's already happened in Pennsylvania. A plant that made the wind turbine blades opened back up and all the workers went back to work. And that was very much an initiative that Conway took. And he also aligned us with the, or got us into the international labor movement in an organization called Mondragon. I mean, not Mondragon, Industrial, which is an international labor movement, which has already helped us win some fights here in the United States. And I won't get into all of that, but I just have to say that this is a terrible loss, not just for our union, but for the whole working class and for the whole international labor movement. And he has a lasting heritage that's just incredibly important. And I just wanted people to know about that. We don't know any of the particulars yet. The family hasn't released any statements, but we're going to find out. And the one last thing I want to say is that now the vice president, Dave, oh my God, me in memory. Anyway, don't get old. Dave McCall, he is of the same kind of background and fighting spirit. And so we're going to continue to have great leadership in the union. Anyway, I just wanted people to know about it. It's just a terrible loss for all of us. Okay, thanks,
thank you,
John.
Thank you, Scott. And as the Quakers say, I will hold Brother Conway in the light. I'd like to ask JB if he could open up for us this morning with a report on his visit to the parts distribution picket line. I saw the photos, so I assume he really was there. And let us know what the conversation was and what happened. Okay.
Well, I don't think it's very much of a surprise that I would be going to a picket line, even though my 30 years in the Marine Engineers, we never had one. We had good contracts and good benefits and didn't see the need to strike, although I felt like it a few times in some of the companies. But I live 2 miles from the plant, so it's hard for me to go by there without stopping and joining in. It's also right there in front of the credit union that we use, that's
right,
associated with the GM. So there's a lot of reasons for me to be there. I went there yesterday also with Danny. I took Danny with me.
Right.
And we visited both pickets. They have one out front on Route 9 and then another one in the back
right,
where the trucks come in to the plant, approximately, I'd say, less than a mile away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And strongly manned
all
by
right,
members. And the membership was very diverse in a lot of ways. There was young kids there. There was a lot of African Americans, a few old guys, but mostly, a lot of women. The lady that's in charge of the picket is a woman. And, she was fantastic. She was great. And everybody's mood was up. The mood was very up. And they discussed with me the way they are doing it, 8 hours on, 2 days off. So it's a pretty good deal. doing 8 hours and then 2 days off before the next shift.
Right. So this different people will be there on Tuesday than Monday, for example, but someone was there on Monday might be back on Wednesday or something.
And our longtime member and former president of the local there, Kenny Collinson, he was there.
All right.
Both times that I was there, he was there. And they didn't give me any trouble about driving a Tesla. So
I see. Okay.
I was surprised. Not one negative comment. So
Good. Maybe they just were muttering under their breath. You never know, right?
I suppose. Well, I'm sure they're. Yeah. Look at there. He's the president. He's driving a Tesla. You know.
Yeah.
But anybody that knows me realizes that's not the case, and I certainly have no love for Elon Musk.
You know, but
he ran me off of Twitter, but now they're saying to come back. Now that everybody's saying we have to fight Twitter on the battleground. Now they renamed it X.
Yeah.
Now Twitter is called X.
Yeah.
Are you on there, John?
Well, I am, but I when I post stuff like podcasts, I post it to I think it's called Winners and Losers on Twitter, but I don't maintain the account really.
Yeah, I remember. You know. Yeah, I remember you were part of my Twitter.
So I don't use it much
when I did it.
I mean, I use Facebook and I use the Google tools. I mean, all my websites that are public are pretty much on Google platforms. You know, so. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's interesting, I digress. It's interesting about this strike is that you're striking three automakers at once. And they all have different business models. Ford seems to be with it. Ford seems to be ahead of the other two in granting the demands of the membership. So therefore, they've been getting concessions. Sean Fain has given them less scrutiny when it comes to the strike, and he's even rewarded them with not striking certain mm-hmm. areas that they've struck the other two, like in the parts department. From what I understand, they didn't strike Ford.
That's correct.
On the parts department, so Ford is still running their parts as usual.
I think it's pretty interesting that they're. Pretty interesting that they're target this ability to have a strike where you target the companies, you know, strategically over who's cooperating and who's not.
Absolutely.
That's a pretty powerful weapon.
That's huge.
And it seems to have cut the company off balance some. The companies. I'm not sure about that yet. I think there's going to be a counterattack. Okay. So, but nonetheless, the president of the United States, for the first time in any history that I know of, unless you want to count Lincoln in some areas of the war, I think it's the first time a president has shown up on a picket line, and he's planning to go into the church. Biden's going to walk a picket line. Barring some unforeseen security problem or whatever. And that's quite a symbol of it's got my head spinning a little bit. And I'm not quite sure what it signifies for a settlement of the strike alongside the union demands, but it certainly does not hurt. And it certainly, I think, takes a lot of worry out of some in the labor movement's minds. I'm sure it would have been mine if I were there. that in addition to the company's resistance, you're going to have to deal with, the state, police and other armed forces, basically starting to get in your shit, so to speak. So it looks like that's not going to happen.
Now, let me echo about Chicago, because we have a Ford plant here, and it's a Ford assembly plant, and it's really like a half hour drive from where I am. We participated, the steelworkers in SOAR participated in, you know, they had what they called practice strikes before it even began, which was basically a rally at the 551, which is the local union hall here. And it's only a couple blocks away from the plant. And we had before the even started, we had an incredible rally, and it had it was like 10 unions there, but it wasn't just unions, which I thought was incredibly important. It was also community organizations. There were some church people there. There were neighbors, there, and all kinds of other support groups that came out for this practice picket. And it was just such a upbeat thing, and people were all just ready to go. And then we did it again last Friday, even though that plant, it wasn't one of the second ones to go out either. It was the same thing. It was, I got a really great picture of SOAR people, including B. Lumpkin, which as you know, it was just so fantastic. And that picture, the steelworkers are now going to publish it in our publications, and we're going to talk about it. And so the steelworkers are really out there. And you know, I'm in the sub-district leadership, and at our meeting, we had a half hour discussion about how to mobilize our people from all over the area to be out on the picket line. And they were there. A lot of people were there. So this strike is getting such incredible unity from the labor movement. The unions that were there, I can't remember all of them, but it was Teamsters, it was machinists, it was teachers, it was, of course, the Chicago Federation of Labor, both the president and the secretary treasurer were there, and on and on and on. The plumbers union, the IBEW, it was not just the industrial unions, it was the trades. And it was just, it's just an incredible, I think, turning point for the labor movement in this country that we're getting this kind of support for all of these strikes.
I think the announcement of a big organizing drive, but public announcement too, targeting Delta, one of the big holdouts on the aircraft, has remained non-union for years. But I think that, if we could be great, I think in addition to the collective bargaining confrontations going on right now, if somehow this could, move in, this wave could move into a breakthrough in some of the larger scale organizational domains, right? I'm not quite, it's got to be some combination of executive and mass movement kind of power to get it to kind of work. But, it'd be nice, I know you mentioned frequently, for example, the examples of how the organizing forces and folks that are active in Amazon and in Starbucks are thinking national. The company has forced them to do that, right? What might have been a left-wing fantasy has now become an urgent necessity. A felicitous outcome. But then the question comes, right? Okay, you got to think about that kind of scale of power, taking place. It's impossible without a political movement behind it, right? That's going to legalize doing that and make it the policy of the government to encourage it. really. Now that, you know, and that's what is so symbolic and wonderful about Biden visiting the picket line, okay, at GM, because that direction, that option, that's got to be on the table. Otherwise, this train wreck of inequality in this country is going to kill us. I mean, it's just going to tear us apart like it has been doing. So it's a national salvation problem, and it's sort of reflected here. And
including that the labor movement is taking such a progressive stand against Trump and against the threat of fascism, basically, is the way I see it. And I don't think we've seen the labor movement lead this kind of movement since FDR. I mean, it's just an incredibly broad movement. And one other point I want to make is the role of young workers in this. I mean, every time I go to any of these things, there are all these young people there leading it and bringing people. Of course, at Amazon and Starbucks, it's mostly young workers. But even in the auto workers, there's a whole bunch of young people that are coming out and being and leading. And that is part of the future, too. We've got to have these intergenerational leadership developing and young workers coming to the fore as leaders of this movement.
Right. Does anyone know? I know the perma-temp issue is a big one. I'm not sure whether Sean Fain was talking about only Ford. I don't think he was. But I was wondering whether the perma-temp workforce at all of the plants, are they members of the union? In the strike, are they going to be eligible for whatever strike benefits if they picket and stuff? Or I wonder how that works. Just, you know, we used to have this problem on strikes and in the UE about, well, what are we going to do about probationary workers? Well, you know, if we don't fight for them, then they could cross picket lines. So, you know, we used to have a weird discussion. It was a difficult discussion in some locals, but I wondered how it was playing out here. But nobody knows. Huh?
I think you have to pay them. I think you have to pay them, and I think that this strike is very important nationally to Amazon and Starbucks and those type of places to show them what they can do. Because right now, you know, you see every day if you watch any TV, Amazon has all these fluffy commercials about how people are, you know, moving up in the company ladder and making more money and having their education paid for and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a false narrative, probably.
You mean all three of those people are getting that?
Yeah, all three of them. Right. You're right. That's probably what it really is, but you know, it's a campaign and they're, it's just like Trump saying that he won the election. You know, Amazon can say we're good to our employees.
Yeah.
And until the employees get out there and say otherwise, the risk of being fired, you know, even if they have to wear, hoods or something, you know, to protect their identity, they got to get out there. They got to get active. And this is a great opportunity for the labor movement to do something. And, and it's a long road. It's not a, I mean, hell, they met Coal down in Alabama. That was two years on the picket line.
Right.
You know, so they realize that, you know, there's good times and bad times. A strike is a bad time, but you have to turn it into something good. You know, you have to make a bad thing, you know, come out in your favor by attracting these other organizations that need to be organized.
I think that's
a big thing. And the president going to the picket line is fantastic. I think that's great.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
You know?
Yeah. I was wondering whether or not, you now that there's some, well, there's 150 people at the parts plant in Martinsburg. Am I right about that? Something like that, or is it more?
I'm not sure, John. I, That's probably close.
But there's going to be 150 people that some of whom are probably going to, I imagine the union is going to encourage some, or as many as practical, to, you know, seek alternative employment to help out with bills, you know, during the strike. And I was wondering whether it would be worthwhile if there were local employers or businesses or other services that you could talk into, like doing temporary employment for people. I don't think it's impossible. Well,
we've got FedEx. FedEx is right next door.
Sure, that's right. So there's
and they're non-union, and those trucks come by and they're honking their horns and giving us the thumbs up.
I know they are. I saw that. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, well, we might, you know, work with maybe Kenny can figure out a way to bring that to the council meeting. We can figure out ways to help. That's all. Because we don't know. I mean, right now, with the president walking a picket line, you would think that the corporations are not going to put up a solid fight and that Ford is about to collapse and come to the union. Although yesterday they announced stopping the construction of the the battery powered plant in Michigan. That didn't sound like a peace proposal to me. That sounded like a potential escalation. I maybe that's just, you know, you're at the 12th hour and everybody starts bringing out their nuclear weapons just before they sign the agreement, you know, kind of thing. I don't know. Okay. But,
that's one of the bargaining chips.
Well, it's a big one. And so if the response of Ford to the demand to have the union cover electric vehicle work, if they don't want to do that, then they punish the state by shutting the plant down, you know, and doing it elsewhere. That, you know, that's an economic threat to the state.
Maybe they're doing it because they want the future to be known so that they can put the right people in the right positions to keep it going. Right now, they don't.
I think that's true. That could be also. You know, that was what their public announcement said.
And that's what I would say. I would say that they're why keep going ahead the way they're going if it's going to change? Why not stop it? And then when the change comes, you know, put the right people in the places that they need to be.
Well, just because I've known quite a few industrial relation managers, and if something like that is announced in the middle of the strike, it's about the strike more than it's about anything else. And it's
the whole thing is about the strike.
Well, that's
they're
what
not
I mean.
Getting. They're so not making money.
But if they start shutting stuff down, that's a counterattack. And
I wanted to mention another important aspect of the strike, and that is the fight against two-tier wages, because that's throughout all industries. And the idea that you can't have that you shouldn't be able to have two-tier wages is an important signal to the, anyway, it's a very important fight. The other thing I wanted to say was, you know, this roving, the tactics that the union's using, like going after the park plants and not striking everything, is just brilliant because it really, really puts pressure on these companies as almost as much as a strike of all the workers would. But it keeps a lot of people working. And I think that's right. Just brilliant. I think the tactics of that was incredibly important.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that reminds me of when I used to run to Australia on the ships back in the 80s, New Zealand and Australia. They had a dock worker strike, and they called it a rolling strike because they had three or four different unions on the tugboats. Only one of them would go out each day, and the other three would be working. And this went on for a while, man. So the other guys got paid while they couldn't do anything because they needed all three of them to run the boat, you know, to run the.
but it slowed everything down.
The towboats, the tugboats.
You know,
and then we got into Sydney in the middle of the trip, and the captain said, "We don't need any stinking towboats. We've got a bow thruster." And, you know, that's a big motor in the front of the ship with a big propeller that allows you to go right and left.
Right.
And in a, you know, very specified manner. And he was right. We docked the ship without any tugboats. But that, and that gave us a week ashore in Sydney, which was great. We loved it.
I thought, doesn't
they couldn't move, they couldn't move cargo or anything. They still were sitting there, you know.
But isn't that the whoever the captain of the port is, isn't there somebody who's in charge of how you have to come in or dock or port or whether you can or not? I mean, I remember being on a cruise ship and trying to get into someplace in Ukraine, actually, and the weather was bad. And they said, you can't come in. The harbor captain, I think they called him, said, you can't come in, not today.
Yeah. For another reason, though. Who knows?
Well, they could, yeah. They knew we were on board and said, we don't want him.
They don't want no communists on here.
No.
So, hey, I sent you Rick Smith contact info.
Okay.
So if you want to get him on the show, I'm sure he'd come
Let's
on.
Let's do that. I'll do that. I'll send him an invite. Yeah. Good idea.
I may be wrong about Chicago. I think he might be Indianapolis, but that's real close. I mean, he's in your area.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you hear him talk and everything, I'm sure his shows are on YouTube if you want to check him out.
I will.
I'm sure he's on YouTube.
I wrote it down,
Indianapolis. Okay. That sounds like John Mellencamp country, you know.
Yeah, sure is.
Now we're showing our age. Yeah. The young people are going, who?
Who?
He had a lot of big hits.
Yeah,
I know, right? But I think he was he went to school in Bloomington. I think for
really?
He was at. He's in Indiana.
He's quite a character. I've seen his interviews. He's pretty good. Pretty good guy.
Yeah.
Right. You know.
And he's in Farm Aid, so you know he's a good guy. You know, he's a labor guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Because Farm Aid is labor, right? That's all labor, right.
There is.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You know, I remember last week I was reading in the news about all the people that were planning on going to Detroit, you know, this week, or last week, or this coming week. And among them was Jamie Dimon. And I kept asking myself, why the hell would he go to Detroit now? You know, and so I started looking it up, and son of a gun, it turns out that Vanguard, probably the country's biggest or second biggest private equity firm, has a big stake in Ford, GM, and
of course
JP Morgan.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking the corporations, you know, must be calling their bankers, you know, and saying, okay, somebody's got to come in and coordinate the defense here. We're getting outplayed.
Yeah, call in Jamie Dimon. That's
he'd be the guy that links them all together, you know, the money guy that, you know, whatever.
He's their straight guy.
He's putting himself out there these days as, quote, very influential, end quote, you know, so, you know.
But you know, that goes to the nicest restaurants.
It's also a sign of the fear of the corporations of what's going on.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, they are beginning to see that this could be turned into a really powerful effort to make them treat their workers all right.
Well,
it's not a threat to their system.
Well, and the very next day, he comes out and slams the Federal Reserve for raising interest rates again, saying that they're going to. What did he say? He said, "You know, when the tide goes out, meaning when credit dries up, you know, and the tide goes out. He says, there's a lot of people that are going to be standing naked. Meaning, you know, that meaning they don't have assets to back their bets. Anyway, we're going to see if that happens.
Let's just hope it's not in public.
Yeah, God help us. That's right. Billionaires without bathrobes. What do you think about the I was going to ask you this question. You know, Sean Payne has been pushing maybe it's just UAW history here, an ideological line of billionaires and the middle class as kind of the and he's been pushing it hard. Does that put it the right way? I mean, that's kind of a new way. Even among progressive trade union leaders, you don't always seem quite put that way. And he's been very strong on it. So I just wondered what your reaction was to that as a style or as an idea. Is it truthful? Is it an accurate way to describe what's in front of the labor movement? What do you think?
I think it's definitely moving in the right direction. It's a strong acknowledgement of the class struggle, that there is a real fight between workers and the corporations. And I think acknowledging that is a huge step in the right direction for the working class. And the fact that it's, you know, I mean, that's being picked up a lot by people.
No, I agree with you.
And it's a chance to educate. You know, all this should be education, you know, so we can get as many people out there that know nothing about unions have some kind of an understanding and how unions benefit workers. That's all we want. Once that happens, boy, anything can happen.
Well, you know, there's a big temptation when you're in a collective bargaining session with a company to confine your problems to that company, kind of domain, and also to be very cautious about saying things that could publicly damage the company's business, meaning the jobs of your members. Okay, and so that those two constraints, despite many very important issues, right? The members rise, and you want fixed, and you might even strike over whatever. You know, it's unusual to avoid the temptation of trying to, we're reaching across the table, we're going to shake hands, but we're going to say really nasty things about you in the press kind of deal, you know. So there's that whole thing. Jim Mattis used to say, you know, it's okay to shake hands, just don't rub bellies. that used to be his line, you know. But it's quite the rhetoric is pretty confrontational and speaks to issues beyond just General Motors or Ford or a thing. And so then at that point, you know, I think you're in a position, you're asking the public has a right to now ask you, okay, so what next, you know, and what kind of reform? We're talking about a reform that's going to be structural for U.S. society. What is that? That's just where our socialist talk starts to come in, I think, or whatever someone's solution to it is. But I think once you get outside that kind of contractual domain, you got to start thinking clearly about the society you're living in.
You know, and I think it raises the possibility of strengthening, for example, the Medicare for All movement and the whole thing that the labor movement's doing about bargaining for the common good. I mean, all of those kind of things are strengthened by this, by what's going on.
Right. Yeah, I think it's that's moving in the right direction. Well, okay, so I still anticipate a substantial. I think it's still too early to call for a complete victory.
Oh yeah.
Even though it looks promising, because I sense that there's going to be a counterattack. But that's okay. If the people are getting fired up, you'll find that attacking the masses of people, not so easy, my friends. Not so easy.
You know, a really interesting thing is going to be Trump's visit to a picket line. It's really hard to figure out how that's going to play. I mean, because undoubtedly there are some workers that have bought into the crap, but
right.
I think there's going to be a pushback against that that's going to be pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, I'd love to see that, Scott. I'm hoping. I got fingers crossed, toes crossed, that they'll run them off the line.
You can cross your toes?
Well,
he's a sailor. He's a sailor.
Pretty flexible there, Scott. Pretty flexible.
Anyway, right. Well, we got any more?
I think it's great, and we'll see what happens, and that's why we tune in. You know, we want to see what happens, and Trump doubled down on his lies here recently, and he needs to be shown the door. You know, just like all these guys in Congress shutting down the government. You know, undoubtedly, John and I'll be down there if they shut down the government. We'll be down there, you know, like we did last time, and you know, the guys that are shutting down the government are the same guys that were behind January 6th.
Yep.
You know, they're traitors.
Yep.
And they should be tried. They should be kicked out of Congress.
There was some little bit more optimistic news. Apparently, there's a faction among the Republicans that is working fairly assiduously to avoid a shutdown. We'll see. We'll see if it works. Because if it works, it might be at the expense of the current Republican leadership.
Absolutely.
Which wouldn't bother me particularly, but I don't know what that portends.
It's like the headless horseman.
Yeah, it's, you know, and plus oil prices are headed back up, at least probably through November, anyway, according to all the oil animals. Anyway, but that's
I
also
drive an electric
good.
Car. I didn't care.
Well, you I just turned both. About the inflation pressures, you know, heading into the holidays.
It's not a good thing.
No. So, and it's very difficult to separate that from the military. It's pretty difficult to do that right now. I think the current military expenditures are the highest per capita GDP that they've been since the Vietnam War. They were higher during Vietnam, a little bit, somewhat. But since then, you're at the highest level. And it's a lot of money. It's over, it's way over $1 trillion now. And so per year.
That's a good place to start.
You know, I don't see Biden making any moves to try and end the Ukrainian mess. You know, I mean, if anyone thinks this, you're going to have a sovereign Ukraine that's armed in NATO on Russia's, the Russians will fight to the last man over that. They will. You know, you look at the history. And the emotions that Putin or whoever the leader is in Russia can draw up over that issue, I don't think they're going to back up on that. So.
Oh, they're saying that we're in the war. The Russians are saying we're in the war.
Well, yeah. I think it's been shown that the U.S. blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. That's in the Times this morning.
Yeah.
They got proof now.
Well, someone's got a photograph of it happening, and of the entrance and exit of a team of U.S. military unit during the time, and you got all this other tied in. Yeah, so I think they
Rutrow.
Well, now the jet fighters, you know, and they're going to, I mean, I understand what they're trying to do, but I agree. I don't think it's going to work.
I mean, yeah. You got,
you know, what they're doing to the Ukrainian people is it's genocide. I mean, it's just.
Right. So they got to come up with a new plan.
Yeah.
Because the plan that we have is sustaining the conflict, but it's not changing
exactly
the odds or anything else.
So
you got to wonder if there is a way to do that. I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean,
it's nuclear. The only thing they have is nuke option. So,
oh my God,
you know, that's the bad part. If we get into a full on conflict with the Russians,
right,
the only thing they have is a nuke. That's right. It, because they're done. They're depleted.
Well, I guess,
you know, now's the time to hit them.
I guess the biggest hope is that a movement really develops even more in Russia against what they're doing. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem very likely that it's going to be strong enough to do anything. But, you know, there are huge amounts of people in Russia who think this is crap and that they shouldn't be doing it. I mean, it is a dictatorship, let's face it. And, you know, a lot of people don't like dictatorships. If they're
what do you mean? They got a parliament.
Yeah, all right.
They do.
Yeah. They all got Putin's name.
No, they don't.
Tattooed on their ass.
There's 11 parties in that parliament. That's not true.
You just have to be careful.
You think he doesn't have support, I think you're wrong. He does.
No, I know.
They don't have any weapons.
I'm not saying he doesn't have
they can find them.
Overwhelming support. What I'm saying is our hope is that a movement that understands how, I mean, and that often occurs in dictatorships where people finally had enough and start fighting. I mean, you know, the whole Prigozhin thing. I mean, it didn't work, but it certainly was and it got significant support among the people of Russia, even though they tamped it down awful fast.
Okay, well, this is a little off topic here for the labor beat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just a little bit, John. You have to edit that out.
Yeah, you know.
I guess they
could get over being a dictatorship. All they have to do is they could start a Republican Party like we have, and then they'd be a democracy.
Yeah.
How about
that? Right. The Republicans will bring them in.
Well, you know,
would that be an improvement or no? I don't think so.
You know, another topic for another time for Labor Beat is let's get somebody from the Russian union movement.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
that's a great idea.
As long as I can speak.
That's right.
I can't speak. My Russian is about 5 words long, you know, so.
That's Radanya.
Even though I visited there as a Russian language student at the University of Kansas in 1968.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and we were told it was a CIA operation. It really was. We didn't know that until later. But, you know, we were told to bring all these books with us and that they would be welcomed at the border.
So we're going to burn them.
You know, we ended up with a long interview with, so why did you bring this book in? I don't know. They told me that it would be helpful in this class we were supposed to take. Anyway. So, but we got in. They didn't harass us really. They just asked us a lot of questions we didn't have any answers for. So, anyway, everybody. So, we didn't get to the Hollywood actors and writers question here, which I know Scott, you had what did you say? The AI is an issue in the writers and actors thing. It's really having to do with, you know, if robots or robotic software can basically mimic what you do, 80% of what you do, it's going to put you out of work without compensating you for any of it. And so this, while I'm not sure whether that particular problem has been solved, I know that the more dire immediate problem, which is payment for streaming, share of streaming revenues for actors and writers, that now the product is sold off these platforms, onto these platforms like Amazon or Netflix or others or Hulu or whatever, and the actors and writers get no additional revenue at all for that. So I think that's been improved. That's they're likely to make improvement on that. The automation issue, a little tougher, I think, down the road. But
well, you know, on that front, that it might be good for us to have a program on AI, because it's affecting so many workers all over the country. And the idea that they can take a famous actor's face and put it on a body that looks like them and then use that in a film is just, it's just so incredible and outrageous. And they're, you know, they're trying to do that kind of thing.
Right.
And I think AI is such a threat to the whole working class movement and to the labor movement. You know, if we could find some experts who really understand what I mean, and there's a lot of challenges to this going on, too. There's a lot of people who are saying we just cannot have this danger of the labor movement and the workers. So I think maybe it would be a good idea to have a show about
that. It would be good to get, again, somebody from EPI or I think they'd be they're actually doing some work on it.
Right.
Actually, the people that are doing more work on it are with an outfit called Equitable Growth, which is a little more, actually a little more mainstream, actually. I think something like Biden put a couple of those people on as Council of Economic Advisors. But they're also doing work. But they're also working on it from the standpoint of mostly lawsuits related to intellectual property. And, you know, I think if you talk to the computer scientists about it, they're going to tell you that that's going to be a pretty hard thing to do, because the power of AI is almost directly proportional to the volume of data at its disposal. And, you know, that power is going to have a considerable force. I mean, just take, for example, let's suppose you, through your AI software or a robotic kind of simulation, can deliver 80% of what a registered nurse could in terms of counseling, diagnosis, service, recommendations, prescriptions, even at certain levels, whatever. And imagine you could distribute that worldwide, where the actual number of registered nurses currently employed in that could never meet that demand ever. At least, well, maybe sometime, but not now. So there you have a material benefit, right, that the automation could deliver, right? It could take the one nurse could effectively administer 100 times the number of patients that he or she did before. So I don't, how are you going to stop the force of that kind of increase in productivity? That's going to be tough.
And just think how valuable that would be if it were for the common good.
Well, yeah,
We could provide for so much for so many people.
But again, if you're going to get the robot nurses performance up to 80%, it's going to have to have oceans of data in the AI world, you know, to do that. Mm-hmm. Which mm-hmm. means you're not going to be able to do that and not violate someone's definition of privacy.
HIPAA.
Which, you know, so I mean, it's going to be. I it's going to be a big struggle, and I imagine that the making AI more powerful in the end will probably win. So
I don't see any way to stop it.
It's got to be regulated, John.
Well, yeah, it does. But the question is, who's going to? I mean, here's the thing: the entire privacy issue rests upon the big tech's possession of profiles.
Exactly.
Okay, that's what the entire issue is related to, because that is the big data, right? Now, the only way I see that you can change that is if the state, which is the public, has access to the same data as these giant corporations have, all right?
Exactly.
And if it does, then there's going to be, everyone's going to join the Borg a little bit more, okay? I mean, it's true. But on the other hand, it's going to be, you know, at least hopefully democratic representatives of the whole population deciding what that direction ought to be. And what those boundaries, you know, ought to be with the data that at that point the state as well has access to. And since it has access to it, then it has the ability to constrain and stop or put boundaries on what the private vehicles are going to do with it, assuming there's, you know, keep in mind, the technology is going to get bigger, better, and better.
And,